You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I am Allison Renborg in Nashville, Tennessee, and you're listening to the monthly Equine Affair episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for June 18th, episode 3976. This episode is brought to you by Equine Affair. Good morning, Horse World.
It's the third Thursday of the month. That means it's time for the Equine Affair episode, North America's premier equine expo and equestrian gathering.
Well, I can't believe it's the third Thursday already of the month. That's very hard to believe. But that means it's Equine Affair Day, and you're looking forward to the next Equine Affair. But I'll tell you what, we got to talk about what's on today's show, and you have a fun show lined up, don't you?
I do. We have a couple of really great guests today that I am very excited to share with you guys. The first is Maria D'Angelo, who's the artist behind our 2026 featured artwork, Colors of the Night. And then we'll be talking with Craig McCoskrey, who is a skilled horseman, an author, and the mounted shooting clinician who will be presenting at Equine Affair in Massachusetts.
That's one of the fastest growing sports out there right now. Disciplines out there is mounted shooting. It's getting so popular.
Well, it's so much fun.
It is so much fun. And you know what? As we're recording this, July 4th, only a couple of weeks away. So we'll be hearing a lot of very loud shooting and things going on, especially where we live in the South. So we did a couple of weeks ago with Jamie, we did the how to desensitize your horses to fireworks. So get on that, people, because time's running out. You have some big announcements coming up here, too, for Equine Affair.
Yeah, we have a lot of big plans in motion, not just for this fall, but we're also doing a ton of pre-planning for next spring. We have some really exciting, really big things going on next year. Big hint, hint, but I can't share too much about it yet. We gotta sit on that one. We gotta let it build. But for this fall, which is what you guys are really thinking about, because it's what, 150 something days away, we are working hard on our Bred for Speed exhibit. So we're going to be bringing the whole speed demon aspect to Massachusetts. And we're also bringing the Cowboy Challenge to Massachusetts. So if you guys had FOMO watching Ashley do our Cowboy Challenge course in her perfect pink Barbie cowgirl outfit, you will get the chance to do it for yourself in November.
Well, now she won't be there. Does that mean you're going to don the pink outfit and demonstrate it for everybody?
Oh, God, no. Oh, I have to find some other Barbie to do that, right?
Yeah, you need a different Barbie, I guess.
No, Ashley won't be there. I don't know if I can share that either. You might see Ashley in Massachusetts one day, but not this year.
Oh, she has said she's trying to do it. She's trying to go to Mass next year. She hasn't.
Okay, good.
She did say that on the show.
So maybe in 2027, you will have Ashley there, but not this fall. So yeah, I got to find someone else to do our Cowboy Challenge course, or finally get my hands on Hayden Crystal's POV. Because like Ashley wore Hayden's camera, haven't seen that footage. Oh, yeah.
Maybe get Hayden to do it at Massachusetts.
Say, yeah, that's true, too. Yeah, we'll find somebody. She'll dress someone in will pink. Demonstrate.
No problem. We,
yeah, but no, I'm not a pink person. I don't wear pink.
Me either. I'm not really good at pink.
You'd probably look very good in it, but...
Did I see...
If you're not a...
I do have a pink shirt, and I have worn it on occasion, but I'm not wearing the pink pants. I'm out when it comes to that. So I see you went on vacation, and you went to the big city?
I did. I went to the big city, and that was actually Ryan's idea. We were visiting his best friend in Philadelphia, and he said, hey, we should go to Philly. We should stay with Z. And then while we're there, we should do some day trips to New York City. Oh. And I was like, are you kidding? Like, me? Me?
Yeah, we're really country bumpkins at heart. So
honestly, yes.
Yeah.
But I was very anxious, and then I surprised myself with how much fun it was. We rode subways. It was my first time on the subway.
Oh, really?
We rode buses. We rode trains. We did the Amtrak. It was a lot of transportation, and the subway is really fun once you get in the hang of it, because it's almost like instant transportation. Like, you go, you disappear into the earth, and then you pop up and you're suddenly in a different borough or a different, you know, you're 20 blocks that direction. And it's just like, oh, this is big. So for me, that was very magical. But the main point of our trip was to go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I had been there once in high school, and they gave us an hour.
Places the size of three city blocks.
Right. They gave me 1 hour in the Met. And actually, that is why we planned this trip and why Ryan said we have to go to the Met so we can rectify that wrong for you, because he's a sweet man. So we went to the Met for an afternoon. We went to the Cloisters. Now, have you heard of the Cloisters?
No.
Okay. My sister told me about this. So this is a satellite museum of the Met. It's in uptown Manhattan, and it's up on this hill, and you have to walk up the hill, or, you know, if you have a car, drive it. But we walked, and it's this gorgeous hike up a very hilly mountain ridge, and it's overlooking the river. And it's basically this gorgeous medieval reconstruction of several different cloisters that features artwork and actual pieces of stone from ruined monasteries.
Wow. I didn't know that.
And it's the home of the unicorn tapestries. So those very famous tapestries that you might have seen in movies or things like that, like The Last Unicorn, famously, is a cartoon from the 80s that featured that artwork heavily. And those are a series of tapestries featuring unicorns from the 1500s or 1400s. And they're stunning. And so that was sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to stand in that room and look at those beautiful tapestries. So we had a great time, and then we went to the Met, and of course, oh, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, yeah, the Met, didn't they do something for the Fire Horse the year?
They did. Yeah, okay. That was one of the things I had to see. So, I mean, we only had a few hours, which is better than 1 hour, but as you said, it's the size of like three cities.
Yeah.
Like,
it's huge.
Like, you walk in there and you go, holy crap, like I could stay here for 3 weeks and not see everything. But we managed to locate the Year of the Fire Horse exhibit. And it was, okay, I was disappointed because it was tiny. It was like 20 feet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was just 20 feet of some very small horse artifacts. And so I was kind of bummed out, but I did see it and I took a lot of pictures and I shared them in the auditors group a few weeks ago. So, but it was still fun. I mean, anytime you see horses, even if it's artwork, is fun. So if you're near the Met or you visit the Met, it's worth seeing because it is cool to see those. It's like there were some little tiny carvings and some big sculptures and some really elaborate artwork on snuff boxes. So that was cool.
Did you happen to stop at the American Museum of Natural History while you were there?
No, we didn't.
Yeah, that's another trip.
Yeah.
You know, of course that became famous with Night at the Museum, the movie. But
isn't Teddy Roosevelt's horse there?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, that's cool. I'm glad you got to do that.
It was fun. I didn't see any real horses. Like we walked past Central Park, but I didn't see any horses there. Just lots of pictures and paintings and sculptures, but it was a fun trip, but I'm glad to be back in my country bumpkin life, I guess.
Yeah, I can only take so much city too before, you know, I'm done. Okay. I need to not hear noise. Well, there's big news times two today. Tickets for Equine Affair in Massachusetts go on sale July the 8th. And there's a new ticket provider, Tix.com. So you got a new way to order tickets now, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
Tix.com is our new ticket, official new ticket partner. You heard it here first.
Okay.
So, and now our old time fans will remember we used to do tickets through them not that long ago, several years ago. So it'll be new but familiar.
Well, starting at 9 a.m. Eastern on July the 8th, tickets for the 2026 Equine Affair and the 2026 Fantasia in Massachusetts go on sale via Tix.com. Equine Affair in Massachusetts will take place from November 12th to the 15th at the Eastern States Exposition. Fantasia returns for a thrilling three-night run on November 12th, 13th, and 14th. So head on over to Tix.com starting on July the 8th. And that particular show in Massachusetts, you really do want to book your Fantasia because it does sell out. So definitely get that booked ahead of time.
Well, if you've seen the lovely trio of horses on our ads or our socials lately, you have already seen our next guest's handiwork. Maria D'Angelo is the talented artist behind this year's featured artwork, Colors of the Night. Maria specializes in equine art and private commissions, and we are beyond excited to get to chat with her today, all the way from New Jersey. So, hi, Maria. Welcome to our show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is, you know, I have been looking at your artwork forever, it feels like, because I work on our ads and our socials and our graphics and all those things, and I see it pretty much every working day. And so it's kind of surreal to finally get to talk to you, because you made it.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about you, first of all. Where do you come from? What do you do? What do you love to do? What do you know about horses?
I'm a native New Yorker. I was born in Staten Island, New York, and I've been drawing since pretty much I've been old enough to pick up a pencil. You know, my family know me as, Maria, the person that draws, ever since I was a little kid.
Aww. Well, it's just kind of natural to express yourself that way. And I think we all start drawing early, but then not all of us become, you know, Michelangelo. So like, what made you keep going with it?
I don't know. My dad was pretty artistic. He painted, but nothing professionally. He just loved to do it. Just a very artistic family. And I was never really encouraged to go into art as a career. I did other things, and probably in 2005, I decided, you know what, I want to try this professionally and try to see if I could do it as a living, because it's always been something that I love to do. It's just something that I constantly want to create. So. And then I went full time with it probably 8 years ago. I was doing it part time. And then 8 years ago, I decided to go full time. And so far, everything's been doing fine.
You're not a starving artist?
Not a starving artist yet. And you know what? During the slow times, I guess I could always go back to a 9-to-5 job if I needed to, but so far I haven't needed to do that. Thank goodness.
Glenn and I know a little bit about that. We don't, you know, we're good at the creative stuff. Why would you work a 9-to-5? Come on.
Yeah. I mean, you do need to pay bills if nothing's coming in, but
it's funny how that works. It just never ends, right? Yeah. But I'm going to get paid in 2 months. You know, that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. Well, you do have to get used to it as an artist, because you go through spurts of, you're constantly busy where all these orders and the galleries sell all at once, and you have shows and everything happens at once. And then you go through like 2 months, 3 months with nothing coming in. So you do have to learn how to live on, you know, keeping something put away a little bit for the slower times, and but it works.
Do you find it too that during those times is when you're supposed to be building up your inventory, but it's also the times that you're kind of least motivated?
So yes, very, very, very true. That is so true. Yeah. It really is, because you get these feelings as an artist of, does anybody really like my work? Nobody wants anything. You know, you go, it's getting easier to wrap my head around. But always working in like a 9-to-5 job, it puts you in a different mindset. And then when you go into a career like this, everything changes. You know, you have to just put your hat on differently and think of things in a different way.
We've been talking a lot on the show and just with people I know about imposter syndrome. And how it never really goes away. It's just, I don't care who you are. You always have a little bit of imposter syndrome. And, you know, that's what you're talking about there, too, because in those down times, you feel like that you're not worth it and nobody loves you.
Like, why am I really doing this? Is this for real?
No, it's true, though.
Am I crazy? Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
Well, and you try when you're on the high points of going, see, you do belong. You can do this. You are great. But then you forget those. When
yes.
You
it's funny how you quickly you forget that.
You forget that really fast.
Yeah. Why do we do that? Why do our brains work that way?
I wish I could figure it out. No.
So you draw beautiful. I mean, I spent a while looking at your website. You don't just do horses, although your horses are amazing, but you do lions and wolves and tigers and bears. Oh my. I mean,
I've even done houses.
Oh, really?
Yeah, believe I didn't it or think... not.
And you don't do a lot of people, but the people you do are stunning. Like,
thank you.
Do you mostly look at pictures or do you like to have a live model? How does your process kind of work?
It depends. I very rarely a live model. Most of the time, like with my commission work, well, with the stuff for the galleries, I try to go out and get as many photographs as I can and then just work from a bunch of different photos. Mm-hmm. And with commissions, same thing. When a person contacts me, say they want their horse drawn, I'll tell them to send me, and I don't care if they think it's too much, send me as many photos of the horse as possible because I want to see what the horse, the color is in different light. I want to see all the little details that make their horse, because you're not like, if you have a Palomino that you're going to draw, you're not just drawing a Palomino horse, you're drawing that particular horse and they have a certain expression and a certain way they hold their ears, and it's all the little details that make that horse theirs.
I got to tell you, so, when I'm looking at your pictures too, especially the headshots of the horses, it's very hard for an artist to get the musculature, the bone structure, and the veins correct. But yours are so detailed. You know, some of the veins are incredible. And that's very hard to do with a horse. And I've talked to many artists who say the same thing, that, you know, that horse's face is so difficult because there's so much to it.
Yeah, I don't have a horse. I've never had a horse. But as often as I can, I try to get out there and find a horse and pet it and look at it and just feel their face, feel them, just to get to know that, you know, where the veins are. And sometimes even if I'm having a problem drawing a horse, I'll go and I'm like, my husband, we have to go find a horse. I need to go and see, you know, and with clients' horses, it so helps to have really good, sharp photos and, you know, it's not easy. So then sometimes I'll have to use my reference photos to see where that particular vein runs and whatnot. But yeah, I'm very into details. So I like to get everything perfect.
Well, and I'm shocked that you haven't had horses because, I mean, you look at your art and I feel like you know what they feel like. You know what they look like. That,
I've
I'm
never
really
had
shocked.
The opportunity. I've never had. I grew up in Staten Island. It's a city. My parents, my family really aren't horse people. I mean, I only got a dog when I was, maybe 17. You know, animal.
Yes.
But I've always wanted them. And I guess that's why I drew, they were the first things that I drew because I've always wanted a horse. So I guess I got that love of them out by getting them on paper.
Well, maybe someday you think you're a horse. You're a horse girl at heart. We can.
I love them. I love everything. I love the smell of them. I just love them.
Well, you were talking a minute ago about your love for detail, and there's this series on your site of like spurs and up close of these really elaborate bits. I mean, that stuff is incredible.
Thank you.
It looks like you could just reach in and touch it and feel the texture. That makes me pretty happy. Amazing.
Yeah, I love it. I love that. Those are vaquero style spade bits and whatnot, and I love the vaquero style bit. Their work, the silver work and the ropes and everything. It's just a work of art in itself. And I always think that those pieces add so much interest and texture into a drawing.
Thank you.
It just makes it very interesting. I love
it. And that makes sense. I look at your birds. You have a whole series of birds on your website too. And like the little fine feathers, like Do you see that, Glenn? Are you?
Yes,
you should go to her website.
No, I'm actually there. And I'm wondering, because you said you like to go out and see horses occasionally. So do you keep some lions and tigers in your backyard, too?
Because, no, I wish.
Because those are pretty good, too.
That would be nice. Even wolves. But no, I mean,
maybe a bear, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Their coats, you know, you can look at your own dog to see what pattern, you know, how the hair is formed, which direction it goes. So there's different things that you can do to, and then going online and finding really detailed photographs where you could zoom in and see which way, you know, which direction the hairs go so that you can capture it in your drawing. But it's all a lot of reference material.
Now, I know a lot of artists
that nice to have a tiger.
I know a lot of artists that do pencil and things like that also play around with doing stuff electronically, right? Because they made the art program so good now. Do you do that at all, or is it all still?
What do you mean electronically?
So they use iPads and things like that, and they okay.
No, I just get really good reference photos and try to zoom in as much as possible. Possible to see the direction of the hairs and all the little details where things fall and whatnot. But no, I don't use my iPad. No.
So you just do straight pencil or things like that on paper, like your old school.
Right. Wow. Right.
How long does it take you to do a piece? I mean, and I guess it all depends on the detail, but
yeah, it depends on the detail. I can go like anywhere from like 3 days on up to a couple of months, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, it just depends. Depends on how large the piece is. And horses, because I've been doing them for so long, they seem to go a little faster because it's like second nature to me.
Okay, I've always wanted to ask this. What happens when you get 3/4 of the way through and you do something totally screw it up? Do you have to start over? Can you cover it up? What?
It just depends. It depends on what you've screwed up. Sometimes you may have to start a piece over, but a lot of times you can fix things. I mean, it just depends on what it is that you mean, if it's a light of erasing and, you know, and with the colored pencil, if you've layered so many colors down already and then something is really wrong, you might have to start over, but I've never had that really happen. I've never had to start a piece over.
So I assume you don't drink coffee by your pieces either then, because that.
Actually, I do. I'm terrible, but it's close, but not next. Yeah. No, I've never had an accident like that happen. Thank God.
Oh, Glenn, now you brought that up. It's going to happen.
God, it's going to happen.
Well, at least you don't paint, and so you don't mix up your paint water with your coffee. Because that happens.
I do paint. I have done oils and I have done watercolor.
Oh. Oh, awesome.
So I do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, don't ever mix your paint water with your coffee. Okay.
You never know. Put a little coffee in the paint. See if it works.
is there a backstory or anything? What can you tell us about Colors of the Night, the piece that we picked for this year?
Well, it came from something I feel real strongly about, and that's horses in motion carry an emotional charge that's almost impossible to explain in words. These are like three horses running together at night, and they're different colors, different energies, but completely unified in that moment. And I had the chestnut represent fire, and the palomino is warmth and power, and the gray is light. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of luminous against that deep blue-black sky, and together they become something bigger than any one of them individually. And the background just strips everything away except the horses and that electric blue that bleeds through it. I just wanted the viewer to feel like they were witnessing something private and something that happens when no one else is supposed to be watching, just that energy.
It does feel like that. It kind of feels like there's nothing else in there except the three horses kind of going together.
Okay, and I have a question for both of you then, because I don't know the answer to this, and I've been doing the show for a long time. So Allison, do you pick the artist and then they draw, or do you pick art that's already out there and then ask? How's that work?
Well, ironically, usually we pick an existing piece, but I think in this case, Maria, wasn't it true that Courtney did this, but
you had liked one that I did that was similar, but I couldn't have you reproduce it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did one very similar to that with three different color horses. But yeah, you picked two. You also picked, I believe it was Onyx.
Mm-hmm.
That was the original one that you were drawn to. You picked the two of them. So I didn't know which one you were going to go to. Onyx, you were able to, I said you were able to reproduce, but.
And we like to pick two. We like to have sort of a primary and then a secondary. And we use the secondary one, in this case, Onyx, in other pages of our event program and things like that.
Cool.
But yeah, in this case, it was sort of a special request that Maria, I think you turned it around really fast too. We were shocked in the office.
Like I said, horses, with horses, I move faster because I've done them for so long. It's almost second nature. Mm-hmm. And I've done some pieces that are huge, that are like a 40 by 30 inch piece.
Wow.
I don't know if you're on my website, but there's one of them. It's called Yellowstone. And that's a pencil, and it's 40 by 30. And that one, believe it or not, as big as it is in pencil, that probably took me maybe 3 weeks, two, three weeks to do. It's just because it's a horse.
All right, that's it. When we're done, give me your address. I'll ship you a horse. And that way you can finally have one.
You have one you want to get rid of, Glenn?
Yeah, I'll gladly ship you one.
I don't have much room for one, but I'll find space.
We need to get you out of New Jersey into a place that has a little acreage.
Oh, I would love to. I want to come out west so bad.
Yeah, well, and I can tell that because you have so much Western influence in your stuff. Yeah. Like, I was shocked when I went and looked. And I was like, oh, she's in New Jersey.
Yep. Since I was a tiny little kid, I've always been drawn to Westerns and the West. And it's just, I love it. I don't know. It must have been a different lifetime or something. I don't know.
We'll have to get you shipped out there. Sorry. Yeah. Go ahead, Glenn.
How do people, if they want to do a custom or they want to buy one of your prints, what do they do?
Oh, they could either go to my website, mariadeangelo.com, or they could email me, mariadeangeloart@aol.com, and just let me know that you want a commission piece, and I'll take it from there. I'll just give you information and speak to you on what you want. I work with people easily, so.
Well, and we'll put, use that in our show notes? That we're talking about to Allison, will that be in the show notes picture?
Yes, we can put Colors of the Night in there.
Okay, great.
And Onyx. Great. Yeah.
Great.
That's terrific. Maria, thanks for joining us. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. It was. It was very fun. I was nervous, but there was nothing to really be nervous about.
No, it's just us.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I so appreciate it.
MariaDeAngelo.com.
This episode is brought to you by Farnam and Endure Gold Killer Fly and Mosquito Control, a new fly spray for horses. Discover fly protection redefined with Endure Gold. Made to annihilate, woo, that one annihilated meat. Made to annihilate flies, ticks, and mosquitoes with brand new EPA-approved ingredients never before seen in equine care. Endure Gold is backed by science and built for hard work, delivering fast knockdown and up to 14 days of fly protection. Add Endure Gold to your arsenal and upgrade your fly control rotation. Well, Craig McCoskrey is a familiar face at Equine Affair. As part of our contracted staff team in Massachusetts, you've seen him working around the vent, dancing during Fantasia intermissions, most famously recently in a inflatable horse costume, and generally being a helping hand for the past 6 years. But he's also an experienced horseman and a level 6 cowboy mounted shooter. In 2025, he was the CMSA Massachusetts State High Point for both revolver and shotgun. And in addition to mounted shooting, he's worked with horses in movies, theater, television, including, and I am so jealous, driving carriages for season 4 of The Gilded Age. All right. Well, Craig, you and your lovely wife, Julie, are very familiar faces to me. I love to see you both every year in Massachusetts. And I've got to ask, because I don't think I've ever gotten to, what's your origin story? How did you end up with us crazy people at Equine Affair?
So the equine affair. So actually, Julie and I met when I was 9 years old at summer horse camp. So that's kind of our horse origin story of how we got together. But we were invited or encouraged to apply with the equine affair from a friend of ours that has worked for the equine affair for many years. And the description was kind of described to us as, you know, just being sort of a jack of all trades, jump in when and where needed. And they thought we'd be a good fit. So we started with the equine affair, working on the grounds crew, I want to say 5 years ago now. And really, it's an amazing opportunity to go to the equine affair and just network with people and see some amazing clinicians and products and meet with everybody. It's really been an amazing, it's hard work when we're there, but the opportunities and the people that we've seen have been really just an amazing experience.
Okay, so, we gotta rewind. You met your wife when you were 9 years old at summer camp?
Yes.
That is the cutest. Okay, I thought my husband and I had a cute origin story, but that's the cutest origin story.
And I hate to say this, but like, I think as parents, we think like, oh, we're going to send our daughter to horse camp to keep them away from boys. And little did her father know that she found me, and I just never, I'm like that stray dog that showed up and never left. So,
but it worked out. So like, have
it worked
you been
out. It worked together out well.
Like since you were 9, basically?
Pretty much. We didn't really start dating until like the end of my high school. Oh. So probably junior year of high school, but we never really started dating. We just kind of were together.
Oh, that's so cute. And then how long have you been married now?
We are going on 21 years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so you're childhood sweethearts.
Do not ask us how many horses we've owned in that time frame, because that's a little bit, we don't know.
Yeah, putting two horse lovers together is kind of a miracle you aren't broke in a ditch, I'm just going to say.
Well, you know, you our dream is to marry a horse person, and then we realize that there's nobody to say no.
Right.
So, hey, I found a horse. What do you think? You know, she actually sent me a listing for two horses, and she was like, I think we need to go buy these.
Oh,
I didn't really say no. It's just, well, how do we, you know, can we put off buying hay this month to, you know?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Can we use our hay money to buy two more hay burners? Yeah, it's not all it's cracked up to be, but she's definitely pretty good about keeping me from buying more horses. Mostly.
And so you're also extremely multi-talented. You do mounted shooting, you do driving, you do movie horses. I mean, how did you get into any of that? How did that start?
So mounted shooting, actually, so starting my horse career with summer camp is I've been an educator my as a career, a teacher. So it's sort of natural to run summer camp programs every year. And so I had a small lesson program, and one of my riding students actually was the one who found mounted shooting for me. He was a really talented kid, kind of following in his sister's footsteps of like picking her discipline. So he started showing her horse, but it wasn't really a good fit for him. And I told him, I said, hey, you know, whatever horse discipline you want, let me know. And we'll kind of take that avenue and I'll help support you find, you know, which discipline would fit for you. And he came back and he said, I really want to do mounted shooting. And growing up, my father had firearms and I was never really into the firearm scene just because I was into horses all the time. I was always at the barn. And so I said, hey, you know what, let's go check this out. So I went and took a lesson with him, and I've been hooked ever since. So that was in 2014 was when I first started, and I really haven't looked back. Not to be biased, I've done a lot of different disciplines, and I really, there's a lot about mounted shooting that has kind of been my landing. I think it's just a great sport, great group of people, incredibly supportive. It really is like none other that I've been in. So that's, it took a kid to convince me to do mounted shooting. And I'm really glad that I took him up and offered to take him for a lesson for that, because it really, it's been incredible. So among the other disciplines of driving, showing, mounted shooting is really just, it's been an incredible passion of mine since I started.
Well, it's such a fun discipline. I was actually exposed to it in college. A mounted shooting group would have their shows in the same building as our horse science classes were taught. We were attached to an arena. So for the first several weeks of the fall semester, we would be in lecture listening to our teachers talk, and then we'd be hearing bang, 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 bang in the back. Because it's
a little
echoes.
Disruptive.
Just a little, but you know, we got used to it. Like, it was just, this was the thing. Every fall semester, there's a mounted shooting show. So you just deal with it. But it's really fun to watch. And I love when people incorporate their costumes into it. I mean, it seems like it's a little bit of cowboy, a little bit of firearm practice, a little bit of speed, a little bit of costumery. I mean, it kind of has a little bit of everything.
Yeah, it's a little bit, it can be as much the Wild West as somebody wants to get into. So the sport itself originated with SAS shooters. So people that were shooting on the ground and you know, somebody said, hey, we could do this on horses. And that's where it sort of started, with people dressing in, you know, period costumes of, you know, the 1800s, what you'd picture in a Wild West. The sport itself, that's not a requirement. You can wear, you know, just sort of your rodeo style jeans. And if you do, then you have to wear chaps or chinks. And the chaps and chinks are quite elaborate. Some of them, you know, people put a lot of time into designing and putting together some pretty nice outfits. So that's kind of a fun part of the sport, is you can wear, be a little bit more fun with your outfits, but at the same time, you're not judged on your outfits. So, you know, you can put together whatever you feel comfortable with.
Yeah, it's a little bit of pageantry.
Yeah.
It doesn't hurt. And so you're very experienced at this. You're a level 6 cowboy mounted shooter. Can you describe what
that means? That's correct. Yeah, so in the sport, everybody starts off, there's different levels split by gender and by ability. So there's a ladies and men's classes starting with a level 1. And then you have to earn a certain number of wins to move up to a 2. And from there, certain number of wins. And as you move up the ranks, you need to have more people that are your level in order for your wins to be qualified. And as you move up, you need more people and you also need more wins. So the level 6 is sort of a journey to get there. And so once you're a level 6, you're a level 6. Even if you get a new horse, you're still at that level. So yeah, it's been really a fun journey to try to get there. But we accomplished it, so pretty exciting.
Is there a really robust mounted shooting community up in New England? Because you're in Mass, right?
That's correct. Yeah, so I'm the head range master for the Bay State Bandits, which is a mounted shooting club in Massachusetts. Unfortunately, the gun laws are fairly restrictive in Massachusetts, so the majority of our competitions are New Hampshire, Maine, Connecticut. We used to have competitions at a farm in Massachusetts, but we've, just because of the gun laws, we now host our shoots outside of the state. But people from Massachusetts travel all over. We have a group of us that's fairly competitive. We drive to Pennsylvania, Ohio, Tennessee, all around.
You've come down my way? You've come all the way to Tennessee?
I have not made that trip, just with my schedule. I did Tunica, Mississippi at one point, so we drove through Tennessee. I haven't personally. I shot in Virginia, but I personally have not done the Tennessee shoots. But good friends of mine go down there every year.
Yeah, that's really cool. So it is wide ranging. You guys are all the way up there, but you come all the way down here. And that's so cool. I wanted to ask, so you are going to present clinics on mounted shooting at Equine Affair in Mass. How is that going to work with the gun laws? Or am I asking a difficult question?
No. So with the Equine Affair, it's something that I've really always, you know, the Equine Affair is something, it's a great opportunity for people to just go and really find, we all have these common interests of horses, but you know, there's an ability to find a discipline that fits people's needs. And so I've really wanted to get mounted shooting into the Massachusetts Equine Affair, but with the restraints, that's not really the best venue to perform or to give a mounted shooting demo, just because there's so many people in close proximity. Mm-hmm. When we do shoot, we use black powder blanks that are certified to not go further than 20 feet. So mm-hmm. it is safe, and we could do it in a facility, but I picture like the Young building where you've got vendors and sales and things going on right next to the arena. And it would certainly, you know, you do have to be aware of people's stress levels and, you know, you can't be just firing off rounds in the middle of a venue like that. So it is difficult to sort of bring the mounted shooting into that type of venue. So I'm going to be doing demo in one of the smaller demo arenas without my horse, just sort of talking mm-hmm. about what mounted shooting is, mounted shooting 101, just to give people an idea of, you know, what the sport is, how to get started in the sport, and then to go from there. And then the second clinic that I'm doing, one of the things that's really kind of amazing about mounted shooting horses is their ability to really go into chaotic environments and mm-hmm. handle themselves with composure. So I put together a clinic. I'm going to be doing a clinic that's calmness in the chaos. And we're going to do a little bit of the training that we would start, similar to what we would do starting a horse at a mounted shooting clinic, a beginner clinic. But we're going to use some other stimulus other than firearms to sort of mm-hmm. control the sound, you know, in that environment. But give the horses an ability to sort of be exposed to some of the scarier things and how to work through those anxieties when you're in a high stimulus environment.
Well, I think that's great. And that's something that can travel across all the disciplines. I mean, even Equine Affair is a little bit of a chaotic environment for the horses yep. at times. I think back to the mounted shooting competitions I've been to. Obviously, there's the noise, and I've got to ask you about that. But there's also the smoke. There's the flashbang. The arenas get really, really smoky really fast, at least yep. the ones that I've been at. And so that's very different, very alarming for the horses who aren't used to it. But, okay, how do you get your horses used to that sound? Are they wearing earplugs? What's happening there? Because you're shooting revolvers yep. and shotguns.
So we shoot revolvers, shotguns, and mm-hmm. rifles. The horses do wear ear protection. That's something I'll cover in the clinic of, you know, how to get earplugs, right. how to get your horse used to wearing them. And then as far as getting used to the sounds, we really start with just sort of a progressive style of training where mm-hmm. you start them off with something smaller, let them sort of get comfortable with that, and then you can progressively increase the intensity of the sound and decrease the proximity. So you get louder and closer, and, you know, until the horses are comfortable within that, you know, you can sort of control their anxiety level within that stimulus. So one of the things that's kind of amazing about it is we were at a mounted shooting event, and it was a banquet. We were sort of celebrating people's accomplishments, and they set off fireworks. And to be in a horse environment to even suggest fireworks is something that I think causes a lot of people yeah. trauma. And that was one of the mm-hmm. things that really made me think about going to the Equine Affair and providing this training opportunities for people.
Mm-hmm. Just today, actually, I saw something posted on Facebook about the 250th of the United States, and the town was posting when they were going to have fireworks. And somebody in town commented, they said, "Oh, it'd be great. That's great. Let me know when I need to drug my horse." And it really brings up a good point of just the ability to prepare our horses for these environments and unexpected fireworks that your neighbors might be setting off or the town might be setting off. And I've heard all sorts of different strategies on getting your horses to basically not commit suicide when there's this extremely loud noises outside. And, you know, I've heard some people that put fans on their horses and turn on music so that, you know, it's really loud inside the barn, trying to drown out the potential explosions that will be happening. And quite honestly, I think our horses pick up on our own anxieties and when we're changing their environment completely on the night that we know that there's going to be explosions. I think when the fireworks start going off, I think the horses hear that and they sort of pick up on the fact that, like, hey, my owners have been preparing me that, you know, tonight's going to be they're changing everything. Tonight's the night I'm going to die. And then by the time the fireworks actually go off, I think it sort of reinforces for the horses, like, well, here it is. You know, this is what they've been preparing me for. And so I think they react sometimes in spite of all of our efforts to try to you know, make it so they don't hear it. Whereas with mounted shooting, our horses are exposed to gunfire all the time. We can shoot off fireworks and they'll just, you know, I don't even think they pick their head up from their hay piles most of the time. And so this idea of progressive training, I think, is something that will translate across disciplines. And so it gives people the ability to prepare their horses for these situations where there is a lot of stimulus, as opposed to just trying to drown it out. We can prepare our horses and put them in a situation where, you know, if my neighbor shoots off fireworks tonight, I know my horses are not going to, they're not going to hurt themselves in their stalls because it's something that we've built up to. So it sort of gives them the opportunity to control the stimulus. So when there is something that's pretty dramatic, they're able to keep their wits with them so they don't hurt themselves, which I think is something that no matter what horse you have is something that people.
Well, it's extremely valuable to have that ability, not just for fireworks, which happens twice a year. And we've all heard those horror stories, but anytime there's a loud noise around, it would be good to have a horse you can trust that they're going to hold their wits together. So yeah. I think that is really smart that that's the direction to take this, because you're totally right. Having a mounted shooting clinic in the middle of equine affair with guns would be a recipe for disaster. So this way, though, you can bring some of those skills and abilities to share with other horse people in a safe, quiet way. And I think that's brilliant. So I'm very excited about that. Will this be your first time presenting a clinic in an expo like this?
In an expo like this, yeah, I usually do anywhere 3 to 4 mounted shooting clinics a year. We try to do with the club, we try to do beginner clinics, and then I do clinics at other barns where people want to host about the sport of mounted shooting. So yeah, this will be my first time at an expo such as this.
Well, that's really exciting. We're honored that we get to be your first, I don't know, big expo. And so I know we're running short on time, but I have to ask you about your book. The listeners have heard me talk about it, The Power of Heart, closer to Christmas, I think, when I learned about it. But I just wanted to hear it from you. Had you ever written a book before?
No. And if you had asked me 3 years ago if I would write a book, the answer would have been no. I really think that this kind of speaks to just really what the equine affair is about, is that every time you go, I think if you go with an open mind, there's always the opportunity to experience something that maybe you haven't experienced or something you haven't thought of before. So I really do owe what started me thinking about writing my book really was that Facebook post. I think maybe you posted it.
I did. I wrote it.
If Santa Claus used horses instead of reindeer, what breed would he use? And I think it was such a great question. And my thought process behind it really led to me writing a book, which I think you got a copy, right?
I do. I have it. It has place of honor in my office.
Awesome. Awesome.
Because it meant so much to me that just kind of a funny, you know, Christmas time is when I can take a chance to just do some fun posts. Like, they don't have to be particularly targeted. And so I was like, oh, this would be fun. And I had no idea until you'd written and published the darn thing that's what it came from. And I was honored. And it's such a cute story. It is about all of these, they're school horses, aren't they, that help Santa?
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, it was kind of humorous. I tell the story all the time, is like Facebook and social media is about, you know, And I sort of laugh in jest, especially where, you know, the political climate and where people are, mm-hmm. is that, you know, it seems like on social media, everybody goes on with their own opinions and tells everybody that they think they're wrong. And, you know, so that post, like, in jest, you know, everybody, if you're an Arab person, you think that Santa would use Arabs or a Morgan person or Frisians or Shetlands. And each of those horses in their own right has, you know, a reason or, you know, why they would be a great horse for Santa to use to deliver presents. But, you know, as with everything in social media, I had my own opinions and I got on and shared them with people. And, you know, I got thinking about it and I said, you know, honestly, I think to Santa Claus, I mean, the story in Rudolph is all about the land of misfit toys and, you know, finding out who you are and using your individual strengths to your advantage. But, you know, I got thinking about it. And I said to Santa Claus, breed wouldn't matter. You know, he would use your average run of the mill grade auction find horses that, you know, maybe don't have the talent or the skills to excel in whatever they're bred to be. But the ones that end up at a summer camp or a lesson program that really understand the love of a child, because I think that is really the magic of Christmas is seeing the joy of kids. And honestly, I think in the horse world, working with horses, I really do honor and think about that. And I never take for granted that time when you see a kid experience their horses for the first time. So being able to just, you know, hug a horse around the neck and, you know, the horse stands there for hours on end, just being brushed and poked and prodded. And the horses, you know, they take it in just as much as we do. So really the book was about sort of honoring those horses. And I saw it in my daughter's horse this past weekend. Actually, we were filming on the set of The Gilded Age for season 4. And all of the horses on set were behind, they were in a parking lot behind sort of a barrier so that the public couldn't get to them. And there was 3 girls that showed up with their dad and they wanted so bad to come in and see the horses. And, you know, they weren't allowed to cross the line just for safety reasons. Mm-hmm. And I looked over and my daughter's horse, like her ears were up and she kind of like nickered to them a little bit. And I was like, oh my gosh, like she gets it, you know, like,
yeah,
she loves her kids. And, you know, we owe so much to those horses that give us that experience, you know, and they don't have to. It's something, it is the love that they give us back is really a gift. And it's something that I never want to take for granted because it is such a special thing.
100%. And I love how you had to drop the Gilded Age in there, which I did.
I did. I'm sorry.
We got to talk about that. And I told Glenn about that. And I said, you're going to be so jealous that you missed this interview because Glenn is a carriage driver. So, all right, real quick, tell it, how did you get that gig? I mean, come on.
So funny enough, that's another, I don't want to promote the Equine Affair too much, but you really
it
never
is our
know.
Podcast.
It is the Equine Affair podcast. So here it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you go to the Equine Affair, you really don't know who you're going to run into or who you're going to meet. And so last year at the Versatile Horse Competition, there was a carriage that the competitors had to ground tie and then get in the carriage, wave a flag and jump out. And so that was a Brougham carriage owned by John Allegra. So he brought the carriage and dropped it off. And John, I don't know if you've had the pleasure of meeting him.
Mm-mm.
He's an incredible character. He did the carriage work for The Greatest Showman and every season of The Gilded Age. So I just started talking with him about the carriage and how we used to have a horse-drawn carriage business before we started a family. And he was like, oh, that's great. You know, like, let me take your phone number. You know, I filmed for The Gilded Age and, you know, and so I gave him my phone number, not expecting anything. And then fast forward a couple months later, I got a call to work with horses on The Gilded Age. So it's kind of another success story of the Equine Affair. So, you know, I kind of owe that experience to you all as well, which is really kind of exciting. But, you know, the thing that I'll tell people is like, really, no matter who you see at the Equine Affair, there's so many talented people amongst us that, you know, you could be shopping somewhere and just, you know, walking next to somebody who's had these amazing experiences. And so just to, you know, keep your ears out and talk with people and meet with people that, you know, you've haven't seen in a couple of years or you've never met before is that, you know, the Equine Affair is just filled with so many people that have that shared passion. And so you never know what opportunities can come from meeting people that you meet there.
Well, I mean, I've been working alongside you since, you know, 2022. I think you were at 21 MA and I was home on maternity leave. So I probably ran into you at 22. And I had no idea you had all of this under the surface. So you just never know. You just got to talk to people, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, tell us, how can people learn more about you? How can they buy your book?
Sure. So the book is The Power of Heart. There is another book by a similar name on Amazon, but you can order it on Amazon. So look for The Power of Heart. You can put in my name, Craig McCoskrey. And so there's a drawing of Santa Claus with a pony. And so you can find it there. As far as mounted shooting, if you wanted to check out on Facebook, anybody can find me on Facebook, add me. I don't want to admit, but my filter for approving friend requests is if we have a mutual friend or a horse in your profile picture, I'll accept it. You know, I think we're all friends. But, you know, you can find me on Facebook. I do have some fun stories on my TikTok account. You can follow along some of the shenanigans we get into. I haven't really posted any pictures or videos from the Gilded Age just because we don't want any spoilers. So right. Until season four comes out. But there are some fun horse videos and mounted shooting, my daughter's trick riding, vaulting, some driving, all sorts of fun different stuff. So if people want to check it out, they can there. But any of the socials, Facebook, TikTok, not huge on Instagram. But if you want to check out my book, that's on Amazon. And again, for mounted shooting, check out CMSA. CMSAevents.com is the mounted shooting website for the National Association. And then for listeners in Massachusetts, it's the Bay State Bandits. But until the equine affair, if anybody wants to reach out to me, I love sharing the sport with people and definitely would love to work with people to get them started.
Perfect. And if you want to meet Craig and hear some of his cool stories and learn from him, you just come to Equine Affair in Massachusetts. We don't have our schedule posted yet, but we will later in the summer, so stay tuned. And thank you, Craig. This was a really fun interview, and I appreciate you coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you.
For regular updates on Equine Affair, including notifications about when signups for Ride with a Pro will go live for this fall or next spring, make sure you subscribe to the Equine Affairs mailing list. You can sign up on the website. After that, just watch your inbox for emails from Equine Affair. Don't like getting email? Follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Equine Affair.
You can learn more about Equine Affair at our website, equineaffair.com, our Facebook page, or our YouTube channel. We have our own separate podcast feed with only our episodes. You just have to search for Equine Affair on your podcast player.
And of course, Horses in the Morning is here 5 days a week. Jamie and I will be back tomorrow with some really bad ads, so check us out then. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Horses in the Morning and, of course, on any podcast player.
And we'll see you at Equine Affair.